Georgia's the new hotbed for musical talent, and the music industry knows it. Record executives are turning their eyes to the Peach State to discover the next big thing. On GPB's Peach Jam podcast, you'll hear those rising Georgia artists before anyone else. Listen and discover the sound of what's next on the Peach Jam podcast from Georgia Public Broadcasting.
Welcome to the Georgia Today podcast. Here, we bring you the latest reports from the GPB newsroom. On today's episode, 475 workers are detained in a massive operation for federal immigration enforcement at Bryan County's Hyundai plant. Atlanta Public Schools plan some mergers. And a new book profiles the story of an Atlanta man whose arrest and trial made him an icon of the LGBTQ community.
Just about everything negative that could happen to a queer person in the 1980s happened to Michael Hardwick. Despite all that, he was resilient.
Today is Friday, September 5th. I'm Sophie Gratis, and this is Georgia Today. Officials with the U.S. Department of Homeland Security say 475 people were detained as the result of a months-long criminal investigation. Most of the people detained were sent to Georgia's Folkston ICE Processing Center. The operation took place yesterday at the sprawling Bryan County site where South Korean automaker Hyundai manufactures electric vehicles. Federal officials say the operation, which they denied was an immigration raid, involved more than 400 agents. There have been no criminal charges filed yet. Special Agent in Charge Stephen Schrank gave details on the operation today in Savannah.
Together, we are sending a clear and unequivocal message that those who exploit our workforce, undermine our economy, and violate federal laws will be held accountable.
The Georgia Democratic Party called the enforcement operation a politically motivated fear tactic. South Korean officials raised concerns, saying the country is sending diplomats to the area. More than 300 members of the Georgia National Guard will be sent to Washington, D.C. to help President Donald Trump's crackdown on the city. Governor Brian Kemp said today the soldiers and support staff will assist in what the president calls a, quote, crime emergency. District officials have blasted the deployment as an illegal use of the military for domestic policing. Thursday marked the one-year anniversary of a mass shooting at Appalachee High School in Barrow County that killed two students and two teachers. Members of the community gathered on campus last night to remember those who were lost. GPB's Chase McGee has more.
Just after sunset, hundreds gathered around the flagpole at Appalachee High School, 1 year after local law enforcement addressed the public from this spot. Students brought signs and bouquets of flowers, creating a makeshift memorial. A large sign honored the four victims, teachers Christina Iremi and Richard Aspinwall, and students Christian Angulo and Mason Schirmerhorn. Below the names were the words, "Love Prevails," a slogan that's since been embraced by the community. The ceremony ended with a candlelight vigil, like the one held in downtown Winder a year ago in the hours after the shooting. For GPB News, I'm Chase McGee in Winder.
Officials from Atlanta Public Schools are planning to merge and consolidate schools to balance enrollments. GPB's Amanda Andrews has more on the facility changes.
Current closure scenarios include plans to combine schools serving select grades, like pre-K to second, with nearby facilities to create one full elementary or middle school. This could mean buildings like the Sutton Middle School 6th grade campus could be repurposed. Tracy Richter is working with the APS board on this project. He says the goal of merging is to minimize learning disruptions for students.
There's research out there that talks about when you change buildings, there's also some regression in learning because not only are you learning a new grade and new content, you're learning new environments.
The public can share their opinions on these initial proposals in an online survey through September 15th. For GPB News, I'm Amanda Andrews.
Metro Atlanta's Rockdale County won't be able to recoup the cost of its emergency response to last year's chemical fire at the biolab facility in Conyers. A federal judge ruled this week that Georgia's free public services doctrine prevents governments from billing private companies for firefighters, mass evacuations, and shelter-in-place orders. The county's lawsuit against the company that produces products to clean pools and spas is still moving forward. Claims of negligence and nuisance remain, along with efforts to recover damages for business losses, property values, and long-term community health impacts. The judge in this case also dismissed a Clean Air Act claim on procedural grounds, but noted the county can refile it at a later date. Rockdale County first sued BioLab in October of 2024, alleging the company's lack of safety measures contributed to the fire that sent a toxic plume of smoke up in the air. If you want an in-depth listen on the BioLab story, check out our podcast, Manufacturing Danger, hosted by GPB's Pamela Kirkland. The president of Georgia Tech says the institution faces considerable risks with the Trump administration's heightened scrutiny of colleges and universities. President Angel Cabrera presented his annual institute address on Thursday. In his speech, he said the Trump administration has canceled $15 million in research projects.
We're ready to do our part in helping our government be more efficient. But without adequate funding from somewhere, we simply cannot afford to do that important work we do on behalf of the American people.
Cabrera also highlighted Georgia Tech's growth. He announced the institute's largest ever single gift, a $100 million bequest from the late Georgia Tech alumnus John Durstein. The U.S. has passed a massive funding bill that includes federal dollars for projects at the ports of Savannah and Brunswick. Southeast Georgia Congressman Buddy Carter said on Thursday that the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers funding includes $66 million for operations and maintenance at both ports. The bill also pays for a new study on deepening Savannah's harbor. It now goes to the U.S. Senate for consideration. A $5 billion redevelopment project in downtown Atlanta has reached a milestone. Centennial Yards said on Thursday that it has opened the first residential tower and ground-up building in the complex. The 19-story building has more than 300 apartment units. Centennial Yards promises to transform a long underused part of downtown, known mostly for rail tracks and parking lots, into a blend of entertainment, dining, shopping, hotels, and apartments.
Georgia is the new hotbed for musical talent, and the music industry knows it. Record executives are turning their eyes to the Peach State to discover the next big thing. On GPB's Peach Jam podcast, you'll hear those rising Georgia artists before anyone else. Listen and discover the sound of what's next on the Peach Jam podcast from Georgia Public Broadcasting.
When the U.S. Supreme Court overturned Roe v. Wade in June of 2022, it said that the 1973 ruling, which legalized abortion, was, quote, on a collision course with the Constitution from the day it was decided. Using similar language, in 2003, the U.S. Supreme Court overturned a Georgia privacy case from 1986, Bowers v. Hardwick. It said that it was, quote, not correct when it was decided and not correct today. The man behind the Georgia case, Michael Hardwick, is the subject of a new book. It's the first biography of the man who became a folk hero in the LGBTQ community for standing up for his right not to be policed in his own bedroom. Martin Padgett wrote the biography called The Many Passions of Michael Hardwick. He spoke to GPB's Orlando Montoya.
Martin, before we get to the case and the law, this is first and foremost a story of a man's life. So can you tell me who Michael Hardwick was and a little about his journey until just prior to the events that led to his case?
He was a bartender. He was a landscape designer. He loved to go out at night and drink and dabble in some other things. We call that just being a normal guy. He was a normal 20-something guy. He was not out to grab media attention. He had a community that already gave him attention. You know, he was a good-looking guy, and he was popular. He was very well known. It was never his intention to become the symbol of the movement, but it happened to him.
The arrest on sodomy charges on August 3rd, 1982. Can you outline what happened that led to his landmark case?
On the July 4th weekend of that year, Michael left the Cove, which is the northeast corner of Piedmont Park. He was seen to have a beer bottle in his hands. His recollection was that he threw the beer bottle in the trash can on the way out the door. He walked down the street, saw a police car pass by, and then he saw the police car turn around. It came back to him, and he was issued a ticket for open container.
And he says he threw the container away.
He said he threw the container away. The police officer said, well, you can, you know, challenge that in court. He believed that he had taken care of the ticket. He went downtown, paid the ticket, had a note written by the court clerk that it was taken care of and that the officer should decide whether he wanted to pursue the warrant or not. On August 3rd, Michael had come back to his apartment from work, had brought a friend home with him, was in his bedroom. The officer came to serve the warrant and got access to the house. It's disputed whether he was allowed to come in or whether he came in by himself. And went back to Michael's bedroom where he found him with another man. And according to Georgia law, that could carry a penalty of up to 20 years in jail.
He was charged with sodomy, which was a felony, 20-year crime at that time.
Yes.
Lawyers come in and say, you ought to fight this. He initially says, I don't know. His mother was worried about him in all of this situation. And he wasn't an activist before he had been arrested.
I think he became an activist because he felt like these were his rights and privacy is supposed to be a right that's extended to all Americans and did not see why his situation would make that any different. The officer had come into the house without permission. He was approached by the ACLU and they convinced him that there could not be a more perfect case to challenge existing sodomy laws. And if Georgia's law was overturned, then that would hold a precedent if they could get it to the Supreme Court. That could invalidate the sodomy laws that were still in effect in another 25 or 26 states at the time. So he thought it was worth it. All the attorneys involved looked at this and they said, a person in the privacy of their own home, this is a great test case for substantive due process, for privacy as it's been upheld. The Fulton County District Attorney had decided not to prosecute the case because he didn't believe that Georgia's application of the law was just. He wanted to see it as a misdemeanor. And he knew that he had a big gay community in the city of Atlanta. And the political reality of the situation is, you know, you cannot strip so many people of rights. Maybe he thought it'd be easier to get rid of their rights if there was a smaller group. But Atlanta had a thriving queer community of a couple hundred thousand people by that point. The state's attorney general decided that we're going to appeal it, take it to the Supreme Court, and they decided to hear it.
The U.S. Supreme Court eventually ruled against him, saying that Georgia had a right to create laws based on morality. If you read the ruling, you see words like deviant,
yes,
crimes against nature. The subtitle of your book says, in the age of AIDS. There was a lot behind the decision that wasn't just legal.
Several of the clerks who worked on some of the memoranda for this case talk about how AIDS was always in the background of the case. The argument always was it is permissible for states to rule on something or to create a law that supports public health, but they have to define how it's applied. So the state is going to have to further delineate why they have the right to create this law. And that, I think, was the goal that they thought most reachable with the Supreme Court case on Michael's side. Send it back to the courts to decide what exactly are the contours of this law.
Michael spoke with the legendary PBS journalist Bill Moyers a few years after the case.
I know that the system works. And when I set out to do this, I never necessarily thought I was going to go to the Supreme Court. And I definitely didn't think I was going to lose at the Supreme Court. But I always had in the back of my mind that what I was setting out to do was to try to change the law. Not necessarily to change it, though, even if I could just lay a foundation for future change.
After that decision, really, there were whole new possibilities of discrimination that were codified so that queer people could be disallowed from adoption, that the states that had sodomy laws felt no urge to take them off the books, that there were states that looked to reengage sodomy laws that were specifically focused against queer people because now they had the Supreme Court's permission to do so. In many ways, the second-class citizenship of queer people was affirmed and was prosecuted, and people were persecuted. So many of the people who came to Washington in 1987 to protest at the March on Washington were there because of Michael. They were there because of the HIV epidemic.
He became a star. He became a hero in the community.
Rock Hudson very publicly became sort of the face of HIV/AIDS. And then not 9 months later, Michael Hardwick lost the decision at the Supreme Court. So suddenly people could attach a real person's life to these theoretical things that they thought were distant and remote from them.
This case changed Michael.
It did.
It changed him so profoundly. He moved to Miami. He became an artist, known for remarkable sculptures and installations.
Just about everything negative that could happen to a queer person in the 1980s happened to Michael Hardwick. Despite all that, he was resilient, and he had the inspiration to take the learnings he had tried to bring to himself and use those to cushion himself against the outside world.
The book is called The Many Passions of Michael Hardwick, Sex and the Supreme Court in the Age of AIDS. And thanks for speaking to me, Martin Padgett.
Thank you.
Martin Padgett's book was the subject of a recent episode of Narrative Edge. That's GPB's podcast and video series about books with Georgia connections. It's co-hosted by Orlando Montoya and Peter Biello. You can find Narrative Edge on your favorite podcast app or on YouTube. That's it for today's edition of Georgia Today. Thank you for listening. If you would like to learn more about these stories, please visit gpb.org/news. If you haven't yet subscribed to this podcast, take a moment right now and keep us current in your podcast feed. If you have feedback, we would love to hear it. Email us at georgiatoday@gpb.org. I'm Sophie Gradas, and we will see you next week.
Georgia is the new hotbed for musical talent, and the music industry knows it. Record executives are turning their eyes to the Peach State to discover the next big thing. On GPB's Peach Jam podcast, you'll hear those rising Georgia artists before anyone else. Listen and discover the sound of what's next on the Peach Jam podcast from Georgia Public Broadcasting.